Ready? Shalom, y'all. This is Mark. I'm over here at Beit Yaakov. Got a pretty good crowd here today. And what we're going to do is a teaching here on Isaiah chapters 23 through 27, just a quick running commentary kind of thing, like we did a few months ago with a few chapters of Isaiah. We're going to start. This is a commentary by Mark Petron from Fulfilling Torah Ministries, and it's copyrighted Mark Petron and all that stuff. So, you know, and it's a common law copyright. If you want to copy it, you can. Just you know, tell people who you got it from. Anyway, all the opinions expressed are those of the speaker and not necessarily those of Beit Yaakov Hebraic Congregation or Hebraic Heritage Ministries International. But they should be. Okay. Let me pull up the. Pulling up the scripture here, Isaiah, in chapter 23, where it says, "The burden of Tyre, howl, ye ships of Tarshish, for it is laid waste, so that there is no house, no entering in. From the land of Kittim, it is revealed to them. Be still, ye inhabitants of the isle, thou whom the merchants of Zidon that pass over the sea have replenished. And by the great waters, the seed of Sihor, the harvest of the river, is her revenue, and she is a mart of nations. Be thou ashamed, O Zidon, for the sea hath spoken, even the strength of the sea, saying, I travail not, nor bring forth children. Neither do I nourish up young men, nor bring up virgins. As at the report concerning Egypt, so shall they be sorely pained at the report of Tyre. Pass ye over to Tarshish, howl, ye inhabitants of the isle. Is this your joyous city, whose antiquity is of ancient days? Her own feet shall carry her afar off to sojourn. Who hath taken this counsel against Tyre, the crowning city, whose merchants are princes, whose traffickers are the honorable of the earth? The Lord of hosts hath purposed it, to stain the pride of all glory, and to bring into contempt all the honorable of the earth. Pass through thy land as a river, O daughter of Tarshish. There is no more strength." I'm going to stop at verse 10. We're going to do a little some commentary on that right now. Chapter 23 is Yahweh's burden for Tyre. Tyre is a city on an island in the eastern Mediterranean Sea, 3/4 mile off the coast of Lebanon, that controlled all trade on the eastern Med for a few hundred years, until Alexander's army in 333 BCE built a causeway out from the shore and tore it down to its foundations. Is there a modern city of Tyre? If there is, I believe it is New York City. The city built on an island that was assumed, that is a assumed center of world trade. It is where the world goes to trade anyway. I don't think it is really where the control lies, but it is the trading center of the earth. If New York City were to be destroyed, trade would come to a standstill for the foreseeable future. Let's see if we can apply this prophecy to New York City, if it is destroyed by any means. Big if. The ships of Tarshish howl for Tyre's loss, for it is laid waste, no house left standing, and none can enter into the city. That description could be of the aftermath of a nuclear attack. Think about that for a minute. The place is laid waste, there's not a house left standing, and no one can enter the city. Okay? Sounds like the aftermath of a nuke to me. It would not take a whole lot of nukes to thoroughly destroy New York City. The ships of Tarshish came from the Atlantic through the Straits of Gibraltar to go to Israel. That could be from Great Britain. For verse 7 calls Tarshish inhabitants of the isles. And Kittim is ID'd in the Aramaic Peshitta as China, which reveals in our passage of scripture here, or is perhaps the source of, Tyre's destruction. Okay? Zidon was Tyre's mother city, and I believe the city torn to the ground to supply the rocks for the causeway to get over to Tyre to tear it down. Sihor, by the way, equals the river of Egypt or the Nile. Do any of these descriptions remind you of an existing city today? Think about it for a minute. How about a mart for the nations? I think this speaks of New York City and the World Trade Center and the United Nations. Egypt is typical of the world system, so the world's financial system is built around New York City, at least for now. Sihor, in this application, would be the Hudson or the East Rivers. That's just a throw-in. New York City is the center of the world's activities, financial on Wall Street, political at the UN, and religious in the TV and radio network headquarters. Yeah, like 30 Rock, where NBC is at, okay? New York City is not ancient like European and Middle Eastern cities, but she is about as old a city as exists in North America. And her roots go back to London and Amsterdam, both quite ancient. New York City is the crowning city of the New World Order, and her merchants are princes. Think about that for a minute. The princes of this earth are the merchants of the world. At least, they act like royalty. And her traffickers are honored in the world system. So who is it that brings her down? Is it the enemy who plants the nukes, or who shoots them from submarines off the coast? Verse 9 tells us to whom it is, who it is that really brings judgment against Tyre. It's Yahweh Tsevaot. Why? To show reality to the peoples of the world that those princes and honorable men were actually contemptuous thieves. We get glimpses of this today in stories like Madoff and Enron. But when Yahweh discovers them, they will be plain for all to see. Discover means to uncover. He's uncovering their... Switch mics? Okay, is that any better? I can't see what you're typing, so I'm assuming that it is. Okay, there is no greater investigative reporter than Yahweh. He will discover, and he will let us know just who it is that these people are. What are the financial strongholds of the world system? In verse 11, let's go back to the scripture because we just finished verse 10. Starting in verse 11, he stretched out his hand, this is Yahweh Tsevaot again, over the sea. He shook the kingdoms. Yahweh hath given a commandment against the merchant city to destroy the strongholds thereof. And he said, thou shalt no more rejoice, O thou oppressed virgin, daughter of Zidon. Arise, pass over to Kittim. There also shalt thou have no rest. That's through verse 12. This paragraph has to do with that. What are the financial strongholds of the world system in verse 11? The New York Stock Exchange, the Fed, international banks. What does Yahweh say of Tyre? Or say to Tyre? You will no longer rejoice. He says that will pass over to Kittim. Remember, the Aramaic Peshitta says that the Kittim is China. Also notice that over the last few months, China has been making talk about changing the currency of the world and taking over that from New York, what it is, okay? But even there, rest will elude the world markets. Will the Wall Street collapse? Well, with the Wall Street collapse, we see some of the world's commercial control moving to China. Okay, so beginning in verse 13 now. Behold, the land of the Chaldeans. This people was not, till the Assyrian founded it for them, that dwell in the wilderness. They set up the towers thereof. They raised up the palaces thereof. And he brought it to ruin. Howl, ye ships of Tarshish, for your strength is laid waste. And it shall come to pass in that day that Tyre shall be forgotten 70 years, according to the days of one king. After the end of 70 years shall Tyre sing as an harlot. Take an harp, go about the city, thou harlot that hast been forgotten. Make sweet melody, sing many songs, that thou mayest be remembered. And it shall come to pass, after the end of 70 years, that the Lord will visit Tyre, and she shall turn to her hire, and shall commit fornication with all the kingdoms of the world upon the face of the earth. And her merchandise and her hire shall be holiness to Yahweh. Her merchandise and her hire shall be holiness to Yahweh. Think about that for a minute. It shall not be treasured nor laid up, for her merchandise shall be for them that dwell before Yahweh, to eat sufficiently and for durable clothing. That's the end of the chapter 23. In verse 13, that speaks of Chaldea, which was not a people until the Assyrian founded it for them. Do you suppose that could be describing Bush's little adventure in Afghanistan and Iraq and the global war on terror? I think it could be. In verse 14, we see the third repetition of the Tarshish howling over Tyre. The physical and economic strength of England, Tarshish, is the United States of America. When England wants to conquer a nation, she sends the U.S. to do the dirty work, while she sits back and plays the diplomat, perhaps helping with a small amount of troops, as they did in Iraq and Afghanistan. Whenever Bush met with the Prime Minister, policy shifted in the United States. In much the same way as when the Israeli and Palestinian Authority Prime Ministers met with Bush, policy there would change. The British have been calling us the colonies since they founded us in the 19th century, and they still do, and it is no joke. We are a colony of England. We always have been. That's why they didn't feel bad about the War of 1812 just coming in and burning down the Library of Congress. Do you know why they did that? Because the 11th Amendment had been passed. I'm sorry, the original 13th Amendment had been passed. And the original 13th Amendment said that no one holding any title of nobility could hold an office in the federal government. Do you know what the lowest title of nobility is? Esquire. Do you know what an esquire is? A lawyer. They had passed a law that no lawyer could be in an office, a federal office, in the United States of America. That had passed and had been ratified by the states that needed to ratify it, and it was being held in the Library of Congress, and guess what the British did? They invaded Washington, D.C., they burned down the White House and the Library of Congress, and they left. Boy, I wonder what they wanted to do. They wanted to kill that, because the lowest title of nobility is a lawyer, and they knew that they needed lawyers in Congress and in the White House in order to control this country. By the way, opinions expressed are those of the people who actually express them, and not necessarily those of Beit Yaakov Hebraic Congregation or Hebraic Heritage Ministries International, but they should be. Verses 15 through and 16 are a bit cryptic to me, but perhaps this refers to our becoming the arms dealer of the world. Beginning in 1939, when Hitler invaded Poland, suddenly Europe is in a war and needs a source for weaponry. Which manufacture and sale was what brought the U.S. out of the Great Depression. Okay, that war is what brought us out of the Great Depression. For 70 years almost, we've been whoring ourselves to every two-bit dictator on earth to make a buck on the death and misery that they inflict with our products. And now, we've created other monsters in Russia and China who saw and copied our success. For your information, the Depression was only great in the United States. No one else calls it the Great Depression. It's just the Depression. Okay? The rest of the world pulled out of it in 3 or 4 years. Here, it lingered for 13 years due to the same kind of government tweaking of the economy that we're seeing today. Only in America can an abject failure like that be sold as an economic victory.
That was in the newspaper, the repository about that.
It was in the Canton Repository about that. I don't read the Canton Repository, but they're obviously very bright people because they figured that out all by themselves, didn't even ask me. It was the Great Depression that made the merchants and traffickers princes and honorable, respectively. It was all a sales job to the gullible saps in flyover country. It was at this time that the phrase, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help you," began to be used to mask the real intention, "I'm from the government and I'm here to enslave you." All opinions expressed are those of the speaker and not necessarily those of Beit Yaakov Hebraic Congregation or Hebraic Heritage Ministries International. But they should be. The fornication in verse 17 is political and religious in nature. Nothing the U.S. government does is holy or set apart to Yahweh. But it is sold as holy and set apart to God. This fornication is physical as it applies to nations and spiritual as it applies to just folks individually. However, even though the merchandise is made for unholy purposes, Yahweh will use them for his remnant and residue. In verse 18, the peddler's wares are used by those who dwell before Yahweh. This describes his people, those who are after his heart. To dwell before him is to be his and to obey him. Yahweh will see to it that sufficient food and clothing are saved from the destruction to supply his people. Yeshua said that he would provide us food and raiment, not houses and lands, until the kingdom. I'm not sure what chapter I got this out of, but verse 17 says, "For Yahweh, your God, is God of gods and Lord of lords, a great God, a mighty and a terrible, which regardeth not persons nor taketh reward. He doth execute the judgment of the fatherless and widow, and loveth the stranger in giving him food and raiment. In verse 6 of someplace in the New Testament, I can't remember where, but godliness with contentment is great gain. 1 Timothy. Don't remember the chapter. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and raiment, let us be content therein. Having food and raiment, let us be content therein. But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. Get that? As long as you've got food and you've got clothes on your back, that you need to be content with. Don't worry about your house. Don't worry about all of that other stuff. Worry about your needs. That's what Yahweh will provide for you. He'll provide your food and your clothing. Everything else you got to worry about. Anyway, do you see where Tyre and New York City missed the boat? They want riches, not godliness. Well, they got the riches. For Yahweh will always give us what we lust for the most. We just have to deal with the consequences of our lusts. Those who dwell with Yahweh, who are after His heart and who obey His voice, by the way, is Yeshua, will have all their needs provided and have the desire of their hearts. Chapter 24, which begins like this. Behold, Yahweh maketh the earth empty, and maketh it waste, and turneth it upside down, and scattereth abroad the inhabitants thereof. That sounds like judgment, doesn't it? And it shall be, as with the people, so with the priest. As with the servant, so with the master. As with the maid, so with her mistress. As with the buyer, so with the seller. As with the lender, so with the borrower. As with the taker of usury, so with the giver of usury to him. The land shall be utterly emptied and utterly spoiled, for Yahweh hath spoken this word. The earth mourneth and fadeth away. The world languisheth and fadeth away. The haughty people of the earth do languish. The earth also is defiled under the inhabitants thereof, because they have transgressed the laws, changed the ordinance, broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore hath the earth devoured the curse. Devoured the earth. Let me start that again. Verse 6. Therefore hath the curse devoured the earth, and they that dwell therein are desolate. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men left. The new wine mourneth, the wine languisheth, all the merry-hearted do sigh. The mirth of tabrets ceaseth. The noise of them that rejoice endeth. The joy of the harp ceaseth. They shall not drink wine with a song. Strong drink shall be bitter to them that drink it. The city of confusion is broken down. Every house is shut up, that no man may come in. We're going to stop at verse 10 and look at some of the commentary. Here we go. The current economic collapse will bring political and social turmoil, and will turn the world upside down. The priests don't set themselves apart to Yahweh, but act just like the hoi polloi, the regular people. Okay? Not only do they act the same, they are in the same economic boat. Position and station in life mean not a whit. In fact, it will be commonplace for the lender to come to the borrower for his sustenance, because the borrower has yet to live on next to nothing. Okay, the borrower has had to live on next to nothing, while the lender will have no clue about how to live in the squalid circumstances that exist.
That's true.
Okay, you and I have had to live on the dregs that we get. The rich people, they're not going to have anything either. And who are they going to have to come to? Us. So as with the lender, so with the borrower. As with the borrower, so with the lender. Okay, as with the giver of taker of usury, so with the giver of usury. I mean, it's going to be the same. We're all going to be in the same boat.
That's right.
Okay, verse 2 describes the economic straits we are in right now, and it may not get any better for a long time. Like when Messiah comes through the clouds with myriads of his saints with him to set up the righteousness and peace. That's when it's going to get better. Verse 3 through 6 tells us what is happening and why. Six times Isaiah uses the Hebrew word ha'aretz, the earth or the land, to describe where this judgment occurs. once he uses Tabael, which the King James translates as world. If all the Eretz references are talking about the earth, that's seven references to the earth. If it talks about the land, talking about Israel, then there are six references to Eretz Israel, and her judgment extends to the whole world. In verse 5, the reason for the judgment is given. They have changed the ordinance and broken the everlasting covenant. The ordinance is Shabbat, as is the everlasting covenant. Exodus chapter 31, verses 12 through 17. It says, "And Yahweh spake unto Moshe, saying, Speak thou also unto the children of Israel, saying, Verily my Sabbaths you shall keep. For it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations." It's interesting that he says the sign is between me and you. Okay? The sign is not between us and him. He's the one that's given us the sign. He's given us the Sabbath that we shall keep. Let's see. "It is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that ye may know that I am Yahweh that doth sanctify you. I'm Yahweh who sets you apart unto me." That's what he says. "Ye shall keep the Sabbath, therefore, for it is holy unto you." It is set apart unto you. He takes the Sabbath that he created in the seventh day of creation, and he set it apart for us. Okay? He set us apart for him. 6 days may work be done, but in the seventh is a Sabbath of rest, holy to Yahweh. Whosoever doth any work in the Shabbat day, he shall surely be put to death. Wherefore, the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations for a perpetual covenant. See, it's a covenant. It's a sign, and it's a covenant. For perpetual covenant. "It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever, for in 6 days Yahweh made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed." Then in Isaiah chapter 56, verses 1 through 8, it says, "Thus saith Yahweh, Keep ye judgment and do justice, for my salvation is near to come and my righteousness to be revealed. Blessed is he that doeth this, and the Son of Man that layeth hold on it, that keepeth the Sabbath from polluting it, and keepeth his hand from doing any evil. Neither let the son of the stranger that hath joined himself to Yahweh speak, saying, Yahweh hath utterly separated me from his people. Neither let the eunuch say, Behold, I am a dry tree. For thus saith Yahweh unto the eunuchs that keep my Sabbaths, and choose the things that please me, and take hold of my covenant. Even to them will I give in mine house and within my walls a place and a name better than of sons and of daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. Also the sons of the stranger that join themselves to Yahweh, to serve him and to love the name of Yahweh, to be his servants, every one that keepeth the Sabbath from polluting it and taketh hold of my covenant, even them will I bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in the house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices shall be accepted upon mine altar, for mine house shall be called a house of prayer for all people. Adonai Yahweh hath gathered the outcasts of Israel," which gathereth the outcasts of Israel, saith, "Yet will I gather others to him, besides those that are gathered unto him."
Well, the church is in trouble.
Oh boy, let me tell you something. People who just disregard his Sabbaths are in deep trouble. There is such a blessing in keeping the Sabbath. Anyway, when we forsake his covenant and his ordinance, that is the Sabbath, we make ourselves common. He sets the Sabbath apart. He sets us apart. He gives the Sabbath to us. Therefore, keeping the Sabbath makes us set apart. And he's done it all. But when we will not do it, we make ourselves common. When we observe to do them, we set ourselves apart unto Yahweh. Okay, verses 7 through 12. Let me read 11 and 12 now, real quick like. "There is a crying for wine in the streets, all joy is darkened, the mirth of the land is gone. In the city is left desolation, and the gate is smitten with destruction." Verses 7 through 11 shows the depression, bitterness, and anguish of the people who just let the grapes hang on the vines. Presumably because they're afraid to go outside. There is no dancing, like there was just a few months ago. The wine and the beer do not bring joy. There are no happy drunks. Just a lots of crying drunks. In verse 12, speaks of the premillennial destruction of the earth and the world system. The cities are destroyed. The gates and the walls provide no protection for the inhabitants. Let me move on to verses 13. Whoops. Verses 13 through... we'll go through 20. When thus it shall be in the midst of the land among the people, there shall be as of the shaking of an olive tree, and as the gleaning grapes when the vintage is done. They shall lift up their voice. They shall sing for the majesty of Yahweh. They shall cry aloud from the sea. Wherefore, glorify ye the Yahweh in the fires, even the name of Yahweh, Elohim of Israel, in the isles of the sea. From the uttermost parts of the earth have we heard songs, even glory to the righteous. But I said, my leanness, woe unto me. The treacherous dealers have dealt treacherously. Yea, the treacherous dealers have dealt very treacherously. Fear and the pit and the snare are upon thee, O inhabitant of the earth. And it shall come to pass that he who fleeth from the house of the fear shall fall into the pit, and he that cometh up out of the midst of the pit shall be taken in the snare. For the windows from on high are open, and the foundations of the earth do shake. The earth is utterly broken down, the earth is clean dissolved, the earth is moved exceedingly. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, and shall be removed like the cottage. And the transgression thereof shall be heavy upon it, and it shall fall and not rise again. I'm going to stop there. And we'll move on from verse 21 in a couple of minutes. We'll finish the chapter. There's only three more verses. And it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high, and the kings of the earth upon the earth. And they shall be gathered together as prisoners are gathered in the pit, and shall be shut up in the prison, and after many days shall they be visited. Then the moon shall be confounded, and the sun ashamed, when Yahweh of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion, and all Jerusalem, and before his ancients gloriously. Verses 13 through 15 is the encouragement in this chapter. I want you to notice that any time that Yahweh, well, almost every time that Yahweh pronounces judgment, somewhere in the judgment he also tells us about the consolation. Okay? Some people will be consoled, even though the judgment's going on everywhere else. There are some people who will be protected from the judgment, even while the judgment is coming down. Okay. Yahweh seldom pronounces a cloud of judgment without also showing a silver lining. He speaks of a remnant who are after his heart, whom he is protecting through the storm, as he did the children of Israel in Goshen. Shaking the olive tree means the harvest of the believing remnant, while gleaning grapes is after the vintage is done, equals the timing of the harvest. This gathering of the remnant will be after Yahweh has stomped the vintage of his wrath. Chapters 25, verses 4 and 5 reveal more about this. After the destruction of life and property in the blast zones, the faithful remnant will rejoice in their deliverance and Yahweh's protection. Isles of the sea equals the place of protection over all the earth to which he's led us. I think that isles of the people who are in the isles of the sea, that's the people who he's protecting through the storm. And it's the isles in the sea that are little places of protection. Okay? Personally, I think that the 144,000 witnesses in Revelation are 144,000 leaders of small congregations. That's my own personal opinion, and I could be wrong about it. I doubt it, but I could be. 144,000 leaders of small congregations that are being protected by Yahweh. And Yahweh provides the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night to protect us from outside. I really believe me, what happened in the Egyptian Exodus is going to happen again. Okay, so watch out for it. Verse 16 speaks of treacherous dealers. These are the world's elite who put on a smile while driving a knife between your ribs. They include self-aggrandizing politicians, central bankers, and religious leaders who use deception and subterfuge to separate their constituents, their customers, and their congregants from their wealth while enslaving them to the world system that they physically control. Hasatan is a spiritual in spiritual control of these men, and nothing happens in the physical unless, now while the physical body has to die before the spiritual body can arise. That is not the way things happen in history. In history, the spiritual happens first. It all gets planned in the spiritual, and then it gets worked out in the physical. Okay? Satan is the guy who's planning this new world order. He's doing it in direct defiance of Yahweh, because he always does that, and he does it in counterfeit of everything that Yahweh has done. So when he shows up, the anti-Messiah, it's not necessarily the opposite of Messiah. It's going to look like the Messiah. Okay? It's going to look like the Messiah, and he's going to accept that worship. Okay, well anyway, moving on. Therefore, the people involved, in other words, what happens in the spiritual manifests in the physical. Therefore, the people involved in the satanic conspiracy against Elohim don't have to be physical acquaintances. They don't have to have seen each other, known each other, ever talked to each other, or even know who each other are. If they're being led by Satan to do the things for the New World Order, okay, they don't need to know each other. They're all being manipulated by the same spiritual forces. It's absolutely in the heart to do it. Exactly right, Liz. They may have never laid eyes on each other and still be conspiring for the New World Order, which is Satan's government. Verse 17 is Yahweh's final warning to the world before his judgment. It is also the final warning to the remnant to be ready to move when the abomination of desolation reveals himself to the world. Matthew 24:15 and following tells us to get out of Dodge when we see him setting up his image in the holy place. Are your bug out bags ready? Will you have to go back to the house to get it? You will not have time to gather it up then. You're going to have it prepared. Okay, so we need to make preparations for the time. We need to be Boy Scouts. Okay, because the time is short, the way I see it anyway. I think it may very well come this year, the abomination of desolation. I believe that the abomination of desolation will take place on the 10th day of the month of Aviv. If it's going to be this year, that's going to be sometime in early March. Okay, we only have a couple of months if it's going to be this year. I could be wrong about that. I could.
I think so.
You think, well, Johnny thinks so, because he thinks that we have a number of years left.
But
that's okay, too. I mean, I agree with a lot of what he's doing there. Okay. Now, there are many, in fact, most evangelical Christians, who have believed the peddlers of the gospel and have bought the idea that they will be raptured out of trouble. When they find themselves in the midst of the Great Tribulation, they will be dazed and confused and completely unable to deal with Jacob's trouble. They will look for a place to hide, but will find none. They won't know where to look. They'll have to rely on Yahweh as they never have before. For these, it will be best to wait on Yahweh's leading, not move precipitously with no idea of where to go. Most in the West have never waited on Yahweh for anything, so it will be very unfamiliar territory for them. We in the West have had everything given to us, or have just charged it, hoping against hope that our circumstances will improve and we'll actually be able to pay that bill off when we get out from under it, you know. In other words, the treacherous dealers have only fooled most of us in the West because we have dealt treacherously ourselves. Listen up. You cannot cheat an honest man. That's the one thing that W.C. Fields said in a couple of his movies that was absolutely the truth. It wasn't a gag. You cannot cheat an honest man. We've gotten treacherously close to our own destruction. Okay? We have lived beyond our means on a promise of readily available credit. You can't cheat an honest man. Believers need to get free of our dependence on credit and live in dependency only on Yahweh. I think he's giving us one last opportunity to truly trust him before he brings sudden destruction on the world. This credit crisis is our last wake-up call. That's what I think. Proverbs 3, verses 1 through 8 says this, "My son, forget not my law, but let thine heart keep my commandments. For length of days and long life and peace shall they add to thee." Let not mercy or truth forsake thee. Bind them about thy neck. Write them upon the tables of your heart. So shalt thou find favor and good understanding in the sight of God and man. Trust Yahweh with all thine heart, and lean not on thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. Be not wise in thine own eyes. Fear Yahweh and depart from evil. It shall be health to thy navel and marrow to thy bones. We can thwart the will of Yahweh, okay, in our lives. But nothing, nothing can stop his shalls. In 2 Peter 3 and verse 9, we see that Yahweh is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. But is that what happens? It's not. We can stop that part of Yahweh's will for us by not repenting. But when Yahweh says, I shall do this or that, you can put it in the bank and collect the interest. If the bank is actually paying interest, which they don't anymore, do they? Anyway, back to the... Look at all the shells in verses 18 through 23. 12 times Yahweh says shall in 6 verses. And what is it that he shall do? He shall destroy the world system. He shall remove everything upon which man has come to depend. There is utter destruction coming for this world's financial, political, and religious systems. System. I use the singular word system because it's all one. The financial, the political, the religious system, they're all one. It's the unholy trinity, if you will. It is satanic and it is Babylonian. In verse 18, it speaks specifically of the windows of heaven opening and the foundations of the earth shaking. Could the latter be the result of the former? In other words, could the foundations of the earth shaking be a result of the windows of heaven being opened? The seventh vial in Revelation chapter 16 and verse 21 speaks of the earth shaking and a great hail from heaven. That could be a meteorite shower. If a large enough meteor were to strike the earth at the proper place and the proper attitude, it could shift the axis of the earth's rotation, perhaps back to pre-flood conditions. Is that what caused the rains of the flood, a meteor shower that tore down that vapor canopy or that cloud canopy, whatever it was, that created a greenhouse on the earth? By the way, greenhouse effect. People are talking about a greenhouse effect and how that's going to destroy life on earth. Let me tell you something. When this earth had a greenhouse, life flourished. That's what it's all about. Okay, anyway. I think that this all takes place during the days of awe, the 10 days between the last trump of the resurrection of the saints and the Day of Atonement, when Yeshua will set his feet on the Mount of Olives. He'll destroy the advancing armies of the earth and proclaim the Yovel year. That'll all happen on the Day of Atonement. Verse 21 says that Yahweh will punish the host of the high ones and the kings of the earth. The high ones are the Illuminati and the demonic host that controls them. The kings are the political leaders of the world system. This is seen in Revelation 19:19 through 20 and verse 3. It may be of physical air forces as well. Host of the high ones equals, in Hebrew, is Tzevaot Marom, host of the high places. Men who actually worship the demons in the high places of the earth. High places were actually on hilltops, were usually rather on hilltops, but that wasn't necessarily true since high can refer to its purpose and the position of the person using it, as in high crimes and misdemeanors in American law.
The
Bohemian Grove is part of this. Verse 22 is a reference to the 1,000 years when Hasatan and his hosts are bound in hell, to be released afterward to lead the ultimate Gog-Magog rebellion against Yahweh Yeshua and his faithful remnant in Revelation 20, verses 7 through 9. The timing of that is Sukkot, in the 1,000th year of the kingdom. What we've seen in chapter 24, is the Great Tribulation, the Days of Awe and the Day of Atonement. Chapter 25 will show us a little bit more detail. I'm going to read the whole of chapter 25 right now because it is only 12 verses. And it goes like this. O Yahweh, thou art my God. I will exalt thee. I will praise thy name, for thou hast done wonderful things. Thy counsels of old are faithfulness and truth. For thou hast made of a city an heap, of a defense city a ruin, a palace of strangers to be no city. It shall never be built. Therefore shall the strange people glorify thee, the city of the terrible nation shall fear thee. For thou hast been a strength to the poor, a strength to the needy in his distress, a refuge from the storm, a shadow from the heat. Think about that for a minute. What will a cloud provide for us but a shadow from the heat, right? Okay, a shadow from the heat. When the blast of the terrible ones is as a storm against the wall. Thou shalt bring down the noise of the strangers as the heat in a dry place, even the heat with the shadow of a cloud. The branch of the terrible ones shall be brought low. And in this mountain shall Yahweh of hosts make unto all people a feast of fat things, a feast of wines on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of wines on the lees well refined. And he will destroy in this mountain the face of the covering cast over all the people, and a veil that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death and victory, and Adonai Yahweh will wipe away tears from off all faces, and the rebuke of his people shall take away from off all the earth, for Yahweh hath spoken it. And it shall be in that day, lo, this is our Elohim. He hath waited, we have waited for him, and he will save us. This is Yahweh. We have waited on for him. We will be glad and rejoice in his salvation. For in this mountain shall the hand of Yahweh rest, and Moab shall be trodden under, down under him, even as straw is trodden down for the dunghill. And he shall spread forth his hands in the midst of them, as he that swimmeth spread forth his hands to swim. And he shall bring down their pride together with the spoils of their hands. And the fortress of the high fort of thy walls shall he bring down, lay low, and bring to the ground, even to the dust. In chapter 25, Isaiah begins with a Hallel and a Brucha of Yahweh. He praises and he blesses Yahweh for his judgment on the world system and his deliverance of his people through it all. He will follow up by making the earth habitable again. Yahweh will make the earth habitable again. His counsels are faithful and true from everlasting. Faithful and true is used concerning Yeshua three times in Revelation. In chapters 3:14, chapter 3 and verse 14, chapter 19 and verse 11, and chapter 22 and verse 6. When Yahweh destroys a place, it is only rebuilt by great cost, or at great cost, in men and material. Jericho, Tyre, Babylon, Jerusalem, and a few others were all destroyed by Yahweh. All were rebuilt, but only Jerusalem at Yahweh's decree. Jericho was rebuilt on the body of the builder's firstborn, and the gates were set on the body of his only surviving son. You can find that in Joshua chapter 6 and 26 and 1 Kings 16:34. When Jerusalem was rebuilt, it was done in adversity, but there is no recorded loss of life among the builders. The palace of strangers is the cities of the earth. I believe that the millennium will see everyone living on a much more agrarian lifestyle, planting food and raising herds and flocks for our sustenance. There will be town centers and probably a few merchants, but no large cities to speak of. They will have been destroyed and probably will not be rebuilt. Verses 4 and 5 speak of Zion in the wilderness of the great tribulation. It refers to the strong people of verse 3 who were spiritually strong and trusting in Yahweh's protection through the storm. Yahweh is their strength, their refuge, and the shadow from the heat of the nuke exchanges that I am convinced will come upon the earth. How will he bring down the heat? He's going to bring down the heat. That's what it says in the scripture. How will he bring down the heat? By the shadow of a cloud. That's interesting, isn't it? Can you think of a time when there was a cloud that protected Yahweh's people from adversaries and their destruction? Might he not do it again? Has he not promised he will do it again? Instead of the rads rising into the upper atmosphere to rain down on the whole earth, will he cause it to settle to the ground near the blast center? He's done more astounding things in the past. He can do supernatural stuff to protect his own while allowing men to destroy themselves, and I believe he shall. Whether that's how he's going to do it, I don't know, but I'm just saying, he can. Verses 6 through 8 shows us what will happen in the post-mill, post-great white throne, new heaven, and new earth. Wines of the lees. That's talking about aged, fine wine, not new wine. What makes it plain that this is post-great world, great white throne, new earth, is verse 7, where the covering of the veil are removed from all men's eyes. This refers to two veils, I believe. The veil that was rent from top to bottom, revealing Torah, opening it to all of our understanding. And the second veil is that which is over the Jews' eyes that hides Yeshua from them, and that is also over the church's eyes that hides Torah from them. The first veil cannot be truly removed until the new heaven and the new earth, where there is no unrighteousness. This is fully revealed in verse 8, when all tears are wiped from all eyes in Revelation chapter 21 and verse 4. Death will be swallowed up in victory in 1 Corinthians 15:54, and no one will rebuke Israel ever again. I use the term Israel with a Y beginning it to set apart the difference between believing Israel and unbelieving Israel. Okay? So you'll hear me say Israel, and that I'm talking about believers. All believers are Israel. Of course, there will be none on earth who is not Israel in the new heavens and the new earth. There will be none on earth at the very beginning of the millennium that are not Israel. Okay? Of course, they will be bearing children, and the children will still have fallen human natures. They will still have evil inclinations, and we'll get into that in a little bit. Did you notice that Yahweh wills? In the new heaven and the new earth, there will be no sin, so there will be no one to thwart His will. His will shall be His shall. The veil over people's eyes can be removed by their own willingness to discover Yahweh's truth and discard man's tradition. In that day means the day of Yahweh, which begins with the last trumpet and the dead and Messiah rising, and really never ends. But in the case of verses 9 through 12, I'm pretty certain that it deals with the time of Jacob's trouble. For we have waited on Yahweh, and we will rejoice in His salvation. Hebrew there, by the way, for His salvation is, or in His salvation, is Be Yeshuato, in His salvation. In that day, He will tear down the strongholds of Israel's enemies and grind them to dust. In chapter 26, chapter 26 has 21 verses. We'll do the first 10. In that day shall this song be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. Salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks. Open ye the gates, that the righteous nation which keepeth the truth may enter in. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusteth in thee. Trust ye in Yahweh forever, for in Yah Yehovah is everlasting strength. This is one of the two or three times where Yahweh's covenant name is used twice in a row. Okay? It's wanting to make sure that you understand that it's Yah who's doing this. For he bringeth down them that dwell on high, the lofty city. He layeth it low. He layeth it low even to the ground. He bringeth it even to the dust. The foot shall tread it down, even the feet of the poor and the steps of the needy. The way of the just is uprightness. Thou most upright dost weigh the path of the just. Yea, in the way of thy judgments, O Yahweh, have we waited for thee. The desire of our soul is to thy name, and to the remembrance of thee. With my soul have I desired thee in the night, yea, with my spirit within me will I seek thee hourly. For when thy judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness. Let favor be showed to the wicked, yet will he not learn righteousness. In the land of uprightness will he deal unjustly, and will not behold the majesty of Yahweh. Yahweh, when thy hand is lifted up, they will not see, but they shall see and be ashamed for their envy at the people. Yea, the fire of thine enemies shall devour them. Wow. This chapter is all about consolation and comfort in the midst of trouble. As each chapter of judgment on the earth has a passage of consolation for the remnant, so this group of chapters has an entire chapter of consolation for them. Yeshua will appoint. Yeshua Yashit is what that is, by the way. Yeshua will appoint. Yeshua Yashit. He will appoint walls and bulwarks. The gates of the king's city, Zion, will be open to the righteous nation, redeemed Israel. Keeps truth. You understand that keep means to make safe, to guard, to protect, to to perform, not just to hold it as it does in our day. In the Bible, it means all of those different things. We make it safe. We keep it. We guard it. We protect it. If you saw the movie or read the book, The Lord of the Rings, the thing where the place where they went, where the Rohan went, was to the Helm's Keep. They went to Helm's Deep, and behind it was an even more secure place called Helm's Keep. And that's where they sent their women and children. Okay? So, keep. It means to protect. It doesn't mean just to have it in your hand and hang on to it. It means to protect it. So what does it say? Yahweh will keep us in perfect peace, whose minds are stayed upon Him. If we keep His truth, He will keep us in perfect peace, even though through the worst of the storms that Hasatan will send on us. While the earth is being destroyed by the power of man, Yahweh will protect those of us who trust in Him and guard His word in our hearts and lives. Revelation chapter 12 and verse 17. For in Yahweh is everlasting strength. He will bring down the ones that dwell on high. Yes?
The everlasting strength there means the rock of ages.
The everlasting strength is the rock of ages. That's exactly right. The everlasting strength of Yahweh is Yeshua, and Yeshua is the rock of ages. We will bring down the ones who dwell on high. On high means those who lord it over others. If you follow the descriptions that follow the semicolon, listen, words on either end of a semicolon are equivalents. Okay? So those who dwell on high equal the lofty city, which He will lay low, even to the ground and to the dust. So what is the lofty city? Is it Jerusalem? Is it New York City? Is it Washington, D.C.? Is it London? Is it Rome? Is it Moscow? Is it all of those? I think we're seeing Yahweh's judgment on folks who set themselves above everyone else, who make rules they don't keep themselves. Sound like Congress? This is, to my mind, the power elite of politicians, industrialists, banksters, and religious leaders who rule over their serfs like feudal lords of the manor. They are political, religious, and economic Babylon. So these who walk all over us poor schlubs in flyover country now will, in verse 6, receive what they dished out. As we're shown in Revelation chapter 16 and verses 5 and 6. And I heard the angel of the waters say, Thou art righteous, Yahweh, which art, which wast, and shalt be, because thou hast judged thus. For they have shed the blood of the saints and prophets, and thou hast given them blood to drink, for they are worthy. Eventually, the unjust of the world, the wicked men of the world, will receive the same judgment that they have laid on the righteous of the world. Can you see that the way of the just, and I believe in verse 7, the way of the just, the path of the just, the way of Yahweh's judgments, that these are all equivalents? Can anyone give me a one-word synonym for all those equivalent descriptions? The way of the just, the path of the just, the way of Yahweh's judgments? Torah. And Yeshua is Torah. So, yes, Torah. In Torah, we wait on Yahweh. Through Torah, we express our desire to keep Him in our memories and be partakers of His name. Our soul is the part of us that blends our flesh to our spirit, that gives us the ability to see, to understand, and to experience spiritual things. If we are born of the Spirit of Yahweh, we can see Abba Yahweh's truth. If not, we see the lies of our father, Hasatan, as truth, because there are only two fathers. Okay? Those who are after Yahweh's heart are Yahweh's children. Those who are not after Yahweh's heart are Hasatan's children. Only those who are after Yahweh's heart will actually see what it is that Yahweh wants them to see. Those who are not after Yahweh's heart will see lies. They'll accept lies. Because that's Satan. He is a liar and the father of lies. Verse 9 shows us that if we desire Him with our souls and seek Him early or diligently with our spirits, we will teach people of His righteousness in the kingdom to come. In that kingdom, Yeshua will rule with a rod of iron, which means that He will strictly enforce His commandments and judgments on the inhabitants of the earth. He will do this either directly by His own hand or via representatives, that is, by us. How many cities will you rule over? You know, the parable about the guy with the 10 talents being given 10 cities to rule. The guy with the 1 talent didn't even get to keep his and was given to the guy with the 10. Now he's got 11 cities to rule, right? Okay. How good are you at doing the things that Yahweh wants you to do? Okay, that's what he's talking about there. So how many cities will you rule? They will learn to live righteously. Everybody on the earth will learn to live righteously. But being born with an inclination to evil, most will comply only because of the rod of iron. They will learn righteousness, but they will not like it. In fact, I think they'll resent it. Most will comply in public, but in their hearts, they'll hope for any chance to rebel successfully. Revelation chapters 20 and verses 7 through 9 shows us what will happen at their first opportunity to rebel. At the end of the millennium, it says, "And when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison, and shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together for battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. And they," that's the nations of the earth, "went up on the breadth of the land and compassed the camp of the saints about and the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them." My favorite verse in the Bible. I love that one. He finally says, you know, I've had enough. Anyway, this, by the way, the timing of this is at the end of the millennium, and it is the Feast of Sukkot. Because we have the camp of the saints camped around the city of Jerusalem, and they're surrounded by the nations of the earth. Okay? It's the one feast of Yahweh that it says in Zechariah chapter 14 will be kept every year. And if you don't go up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, then you don't get rain the next year. That's to give you the idea. Well, you know what? Maybe you ought to go up to the Feast of Tabernacles. That way you'll be able to eat. Maybe we ought to start practicing it now. Oh, did I hear that come out of somebody in this room?
Good idea.
Isaiah chapter 26 and verses 10 and 11 show exactly that. They are shown favor by the rod, but they will not learn from the rod. The root word for learn, by the way, is lamad. Now, the Hebrew letter, lamed, 12th letter of the Hebrew language, in the ancient Hebrew pictographs, is the picture of a shepherd's staff or a goad, and it's that thing by which the shepherd would keep his sheep in line, and sometimes he would have to keep them in line by knocking them on the head. Okay, sheep would go, "Whoa, what was that all about?" Then the sheep's heart would be shown. The sheep's heart is shown at this point by either him going, "Oh man," and running to the shepherd for comfort, or running further away from the shepherd to get away from the judgment. That's how our heart, these people's hearts will be shown as well. If they get the whack on the head from the rod of iron, will they repent and come back to the shepherd, or will they rebel and move away from him? Now, they will do what they're told, but what's their heart going to do? That's the question. Okay, how the sheep responds to the correction is what determines the sheep's heart for the shepherd. Most will harden their hearts at being forced to go up to the Feast of Sukkot every year in Zechariah chapter 14, and will gladly follow HaSatan when he is released from his chains. That's what we read in Revelation chapter 20 and verses 7 through 9. Okay, starting in verse 12 of 26. "Yahweh, thou wilt ordain peace for us, for thou also hast wrought all our works in us. Yahweh Eloheinu, other lords beside thee have had dominion over us, but by thee only will we make mention of thy name. They are dead, they shall not live. They are deceased, they shall not rise. Therefore hast thou visited and destroyed them and made all their memory to perish. Thou hast increased the nation, O Yahweh. Thou hast increased the nation, thou hast glorified, thou hast removed it far unto all the ends of the earth. Yahweh, in trouble have they visited thee. They poured out a prayer when thy chastening was upon them. like as a woman with child that draweth near the time of her delivery, is in pain, and crieth out in her pangs, so have we been in thy sight, O Yahweh. We have been with child. We have been in pain. We have, as it were, brought forth wind. We have not wrought any deliverance in the earth, neither have the inhabitants of the world fallen. Thy dead men shall live, together with my dead body shall they rise. Together with my dead body shall they arise. Awake and sing, ye that dwell in dust, for thy dew is as the dew of herbs, and the earth shall cast out the dead. Come, my people, enter thou into the chambers, and shut thy doors about thee. Hide thyself, as it were, for a little moment, until the indignation be overpassed. For, behold, Yahweh cometh out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth also shall disclose her blood, and shall no more cover her slain. In verses 12 to 14, Yahweh ordains peace to those who allow him to be their righteousness. Verse 12b can be seen in the New Testament in Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 10 and Philippians chapter 2 and verse 13. For we are his workmanship, created in Messiah Yeshua unto good works. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Okay? After being saved by the power of Yahweh through the faith of Yeshua, not our own faith, but Yeshua's faith, he works his Torah in us for his good pleasure. He works out our salvation with fear and trembling. He works out our salvation with fear and trembling. Our part in this is submission to his word. But we have submitted to other gods. Said so, right there. It said other lords we have submitted to. In fact, if we're honest with ourselves, we're still submitting secretly to another god in some area of our lives. Though we won't acknowledge it publicly, and actually we shouldn't, specifically. Unless we've actually done something against someone, then we should confess that sin against them. But it is only by the Spirit of Yahweh that we can truly acknowledge his name, Yahweh Yeshua HaMashiach. Those other lords to whom we've submitted, being dead, shall not live. Look at Revelation chapter 20 and verse 10. Look, we just saw 7 through 9. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are, and shall be tormented day and night forever and ever. The beast and the false prophet, who represent the false gods that we've submitted to, never resurrect from the dead. They were sent directly from the field of battle in Revelation 19 to the lake of fire. They didn't pass go. They didn't collect $200. In verse 15, there is an allusion to the two houses of Jacob when he repeats, "You have increased the nation. You have increased the nation." He has increased both houses during their respective exiles. Think about that for a minute. That he has. Ephraim, he has made into a multitude of nations. And Judah went out a few thousand or a few hundred thousand and came and are right now 20 or 30 million. Where was I? Here we go. Note the colon, which connects two different standalone sentences that illustrate each other. You look at that in verse 15. Pretty sure. We see, "Thou hast increased the nation, O Yahweh, thou hast increased the nation." Colon. "Thou art glorified, thou hast removed it far unto all the ends of the earth." Those are separate standalone sentences, but they amplify each other. Okay? So, "Thou hast increased the nation, thou hast increased the nation." That's how he's glorified. And he's glorified by us being removed into the far corners of the earth. Okay. As the woman in Revelation 12 is in pains to be delivered, so are we in our time of trouble. It is not like a woman in travail, but as. As denotes a metaphorical likeness, not a similitude. Similar in aspect or principle, but not the same kind. In other words, it is not physical pain, but emotional and spiritual distress that we're going through in Revelation chapter 12. When Yahweh's people understand their chastisement, they call upon his name. I think verse 17 speaks of our attempts to do Yahweh's will and word in our own strength, because verse 18 says that we have been in pain and with child, but we brought forth wind. Do you see the way that's circumlocuted? The King James translators were, shall we say, delicate in their choice of words. It means that we worked our tails off and all we produced was a malodorous outgassing. Noxious fumes. Okay? Think about that for a minute. I just circumlocuted too, but I didn't do it quite as nicely as the King James people did. We worked really hard and produced no deliverance. We tried all we could think of, and the pagans are still all around us. What Isaiah is doing in verse 18 is taking personal ownership for the sins of Israel and Judah, personally repenting and turning back to Yah's ways for Jacob. Daniel did the same thing in chapter 9 of his book. This is what we need to do, perhaps for our nation, but perhaps for our families. How about our families? Those of us who are believers, those of us who are priests of Yah, we ought to be taking ownership for the sins of our families. Okay? And I'm talking about our families could be going back 10, 15 generations. We should take ownership of those sins, confess them to Yah, and have them forgiven. Okay. How about our neighborhoods? Maybe we could do that for our neighborhoods, too. Maybe we could do that for the schools that we're in. Maybe we could do that for the companies that we work for. Verse 19 follows verse 18 like winter follows autumn. Verse 18 needs verse 19 like the winter needs the spring. I need you like the flower. Oh, I'm sorry. Yahweh's dead shall live together with me. Even though we have been unfaithful and unfruitful, we will still rise from the dead because Yahweh Yeshua is faithful and fruitful. Do you see that last phrase? The earth shall cast out her dead. The earth shall vomit them out. After the millennial kingdom of Mashiach will follow the great white throne judgment of the earth. Before he recreates the earth, he will remove all that was making the old karet, or defiled and unclean. Death, the curse of Adam's Torahlessness, will be removed from the earth. Yeshua will cease to speak his sustaining words. The universe, we know, will be dissolved, and a new heaven and a new earth will be spoken into existence in its place by the same Yahweh Yeshua who created the first. With the dead removed, the earth still needs a mikvah to be pronounced clean. However, in Noah's day, it got a mikvah, and Yahweh promised that he would never mikvah the earth again. So, it can't be pronounced clean according to the Torah. It needs to be purged, and it will be purged by burning. When Yeshua removes his sustaining influence, the atoms will just dissolve. That's what it tells us in 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 10. Okay, in verses 20 and 21, they deal with what we need to do now. Yahweh speaks of your chambers. The word there is cheder, innermost chamber. This would be an intimate place, one where only a select few would be allowed. I take this to be the small kahal we will have for support and solace in the end of days. It will be the place where Yah will protect us after he blows the shofar. We will be there for only a short time until the indignation is overpassed. Think about the word there, overpassed. Does it sound like anything else that we might... Rosie said Passover. Very good, Rosie. Exactly. Could it be the Passover? Yahweh's wrath is being poured out and we are protected from it like Israel was protected in Golan from the plagues. So when the indignation is overpassed, that's when we're delivered. That is the 10 days of awe. Okay, on to chapter 27, last chapter. I promise you won't have to listen to me much longer. Okay, verse 1. In that day, Yahweh with his sore and great and strong sword shall punish Leviathan the piercing serpent, even Leviathan that crooked serpent, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea. There is a mouthful. My goodness. In that day, sing ye unto her a vineyard of red wine. I, Yahweh, will do keep it. I will water it every moment, lest any hurt it. I will keep it night and day. Fury is not in me. Who would set the briars and thorns against me in battle? I would go through them. I would burn them together. Or, let him take hold of my strength, that he may make peace with me, and he shall make peace with me. He shall cause them that come to Jacob to take root. Israel shall blossom and bud, and fill the face of the earth, of the world, with fruit. Hath he smitten him, as he smote those that smote him? Or is he slain according to the slaughter of them that are slain by him? In measure, when it shooteth forth, thou wilt debate with it. He stayeth his rough wind in the day of the east wind. By this, therefore, shall the iniquity of Jacob be purged. And this is all the fruit to take away his sin, when he maketh all the stones of the altar as chalk stones that are beaten in sunder. The groves and images shall not stand up. Yet the defense city shall be desolate, and the habitation forsaken, and left like a wilderness. There shall the calf feed, and there shall he lie down and consume the branches thereof. When the boughs thereof are withered, they shall be broken off. The women come and set them on fire, for it is a people of no understanding. Therefore he that made them will have not have mercy on them. Come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall beat off from the channel of the river unto the stream of Egypt, and ye shall be gathered one by one, O ye children of Israel. And it shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown, and ye shall, and they shall come which were ready to perish in the land of Assyria, and the outcasts in the land of Egypt, and shall worship Yahweh in the holy mount of Jerusalem. Chapter 26 ended with the remnant being protected from the wrath of Yahweh. Chapter 27 begins with the wrath of Yahweh being meted out on Leviathan. In Revelation chapter 12 it says, "And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast down with him." Here he is, the piercing serpent, the crooked serpent that is in the sea. In the sea speaks of his control of the nations of the earth. He lives in the sea of humanity, in the hearts of men, which hearts are deceitful and desperately wicked, like the serpent, the crooked and piercing serpent. In the zodiac, Leviathan is called Draco. Draco wraps around half of the night sky. During the month of September and October, its head rises at sundown and sets at sunset, at sunrise rather. Kind of depicting the 2,000 years between Yeshua's ascension, when Satan began to wedge himself into the way by deceiving believers into compromising the pure faith of Messiah, and his return, when he will cast Satan to the earth. Draco's tail pierces between Ursa Major and Ursa Minor, which in the Hebrew Dendera or Zodiac is called the greater and lesser sheepfolds. Okay, represent Ephraim and Judah. It is Leviathan who works his deceitful ways to keep the brothers apart. He has twisted our thinking so that we have all gone out of the way. We need to take him by his tail, as Moshe did the serpent that devoured the satanic counterfeits with Yahweh's rod. Think about that for a minute. Moshe had a rod, a staff. He was a shepherd, after all. He had a staff. And Moshe says, "What's that in your?" Yahweh says, "What's that in your hand?" And Moshe says, "Well, it's a rod." He said, "Cast it to the ground." You cast it to the ground, and it becomes a serpent. That's kind of strange. Then Yahweh, he runs away because he's barefoot and he's worried that the snake's going to bite him, right? Yahweh says, "No, no, no, come back here. Pick him up by the tail." Moshe says, "Pick up a poisonous snake by the tail? Are you nuts?" But he reaches down and he grabs him by the tail. He believes Yahweh. He trusts him. He reaches down and he grabs that serpent by the tail, and that thing became a rod in his hand again. Right? Then he went down and he did it before Pharaoh, and Pharaoh's guys did the same thing. They cast down their rods and they became serpents. But Moshe's serpent ate up all the others. And then he reached down and picked up that serpent. I'm sorry, it was Aaron. Picked up that serpent by the tail, and it became a rod in his hand again. You know what that signifies? That rod became Satan, the serpent. Okay, all of the junior priests threw down theirs, and they're run by junior demons, right? He cast theirs down. Yahweh made Satan eat, devour the other serpent, the other serpents, right? Okay, so he made Satan work against himself. And then Aaron reaches down and picks that rod up by the tail. Let me tell you something, folks. We have nothing to worry about from Satan and from his demons. Nothing. We have Yahweh behind us. Yahweh, it's exactly right. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. That has to do the same thing with the New World Order that's being set up, because that's all being run by Satan and his devils. We don't have to worry about that. We've got Yahweh on our side. All we have to do is trust him. That is a big, big order. Do you really trust Yahweh in everything that you do? Moses did, and that's why he was able to pick that certain serpent up by the tail, because he knew that Yahweh was going to take care of him.
Syria, Babylon, and Egypt are represented by the sword, which is instigated by the serpent.
That's right. Syria, Babylon, and which? Egypt. The three great enemies of Israel live by the sword, which the sword is instigated by the serpent. That's exactly right. Saw that with Esau. Esau used a branch, but still, exactly the same thing. Okay, where did we go? Here we go. Moshe showed that Yahweh has control of the serpent and that he trusted Yahweh to protect him by picking up that serpent by the tail, as Yahweh had told him. Yahweh had used Satan to devour his own devilish servants in Egypt, and then showed that the man fully given to Yahweh has nothing to fear from his adversary. Verses 2 and 3 speak of Yahweh's protection of his people through the storm. His remnant is the vineyard. Her, it says, Yahweh's bride, whom he protects, is the vineyard. Israel is the vineyard, and the red wine is the blood of Mashiach applied to the hearts of his people Israel. Yahweh keeps, guards, and tends his vineyard. He gives us all we need to survive while he makes the earth ready for us to occupy. None will hurt us because Yahweh protects us night and day. He puts that cloud over us, a pillar of cloud by day, a pillar of fire by night to protect us. Verses 4 and 5 show the deliberate and methodical manner of Yahweh's judgment after his wrath is appeased. Notice that after the days of awe, there is no fury left in him. The days of awe happen in verse 1, where he puts down Leviathan. So it says, he gives the armies of the earth who come against him a choice. In verse 4 he says, fury is not in me. Who would set the briars and thorns against me in battle? I would go through them, I would burn them together. Briars is from the Hebrew word 8068, shamir, literally a thorn that pricks or scratches. I think it's interesting that the late Prime Minister of Israel's name was Yitzhak Shamir, laughter, who pricks and annoys. I'll tell you what, he was an annoyance to the people that came against Israel. Anyway, his name fit his personality to a T. In our verse, Yah sees it as an irritant. Thorn is from the Hebrew word 7898, shayit, scrub or trash, wild growth of weeds or briars. I see them in this prophecy both as terrorists and as tares sown among the wheat, good for nothing except to be burned. So the minor irritants that do nothing but choke the spiritual life out of his people are about to be burnt in the fire of judgment. This judgment is not meted out in fury, remember, but in objective, deliberate righteousness. Those who would destroy Yahweh's bride will be dealt with in decisive calm. But, before he does so, he understands that among the tares are those who have heard and understood the gospel. So he throws in, or, let him take hold of my strength, that he may make peace with me, and he shall make peace with me. Yahweh actually offers his salvation to the ones arrayed against him in battle, and it is not an idle offer. If they will take hold of his strength, Mashiach is Yahweh's right hand and his right arm. Not only may they have peace with Yahweh, but he shall have peace with Yahweh. Shall, not will, shall. There ain't no two ways about it. If you take hold of my peace, I shall give you peace. To have peace with Yahweh is the gospel in a nutshell, the simplest way to put humanity's need. We need to be at peace with our Creator. Mashiach is that peace. Do you see the mercy of Yahweh here? I do in spades. Those who were sent by their legal authorities to make war with Yahweh are offered peace. Last chance. This proves 2 Peter 3:9 is true. For he is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. These are the heir of Rob, the mixed multitude of the end of days, I think. Like the heir of Rob of the Egyptian Exodus. Taking hold of Yahweh's strength is like painting your lintels and doorposts with the Lamb's blood. Boy, are you setting yourself apart when you do that. Here they are arrayed in battle against Yahweh. Yahweh says, take hold of my strength and you shall have peace. Wow. Whew. Any that turn to him at this time will prove the parable of the 11th hour workman, because in verse 6 we see, remember the 11th hour workman? Okay, the guy went out and to hire people to work in his fields. And he goes out the first hour and he finds his people and they go to work for 11 hours. He says, I'll pay you a denarius. I'll pay you a shekel. And then he goes out an hour or two later and he finds some more people just standing around. He says, hey, go work in my, I'll pay you what it's worth. The 11th hour of a 12-hour day, he goes out and he finds some more people just standing around doing nothing. He says, hey, go work in my field. I'll pay you what it's worth. Last one first. And he pays him a shekel. And he pays the next one a shekel. And he pays every one of those guys a shekel. They all get the same reward, no matter how long they work for him. Boy, the guys that came on first, they didn't like it. I'll tell you what. Well, anyway, in verse 6 it says, he shall cause them that come of Jacob to take root. Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit. When a person makes peace with Yah, he is immediately grafted into the root of Israel, Mashiach Yeshua. These who have turned from their own way, or rather from their own ways, to walk in peace with Yahweh, will take root and fill the face of the whole earth in the kingdom to come. Finally, Israel will do what Israel was supposed to do in the days after the Egyptian Exodus, destroying the pagan high places and groves and being priests to the world by teaching them Torah and the corresponding love of Yahweh, our Redeemer. All the world will learn Torah. Their descendants will learn too, but most of them, their descendants, will not believe it. In verses 7 through 11, we talked about that before. In verse 7 and 11 are an account of the calm, deliberate judgment that Yahweh brings on the earth. You'll notice that Israel will be his right arm and hand in bringing the cleansing of Ha'aretz. Verse 7 is a little difficult to decipher with all the he's and him's, but the passage has to do with the attitude of the action taken. When Yeshua was smitten of men, it was in hatred and bloodlust against one who loved them unconditionally. When he smites them back, it is in the same love that a father has for a wayward child. His love is not diminished by the child's misconduct, but he has to correct his child. To fail to correct his child is not to love for the child, but love for self, wanting the child's approval over what's best for him. You know, when you see a mother or a father that will not discipline their child, it's because they want that child to approve of them. They don't want that child to live righteously. They want their child's approval. That is what we call approbation lust, and it's wicked. Okay? We saw that in the market. That's right. My wife and I, we see that all the time in the market. But yeah, there was a little kid walking around. He's like maybe 8 or 9. And he has his pants pulled down. I mean, not just his down, and he's showing his butt. Right? And I looked at that and I went, I cannot believe I'm seeing that. And he's having a good time. And I said, would you do me a favor and have your kid pull up his pants? Because I don't want to see his butt. My wife grabbed me and pulled me away real quick. But you know what? They're encouraging that kid because they don't love the kid. They want the kid to approve of them. Let me tell you something. Discipline your children. You will not harm them. Okay, where was I? His love is not diminished by the child's misconduct, but he has to correct the child. To fail to correct is not to love the child, but love for self, wanting the child's approval over what's best for him. There is nothing more selfish than a parent who will not discipline his child. Sometimes a good parent of an unruly child will have to banish a child from the family over egregious sins against the family, as a congregation must sometimes excise a person from fellowship over an egregious sin, like in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. The purpose is to bring the offending party to repentance and back into fellowship. This is usually Yahweh's purpose in judgment, to bring repentance. But sometimes the offender becomes reprobate and will pridefully walk away from his authority. That person must be cut off to keep the sin out of the camp. Yahweh is about to set up a kingdom, and it will be started in righteousness. There will be no outside influence to evil, no reminders of the idolatry of the past. 1,000 years, Satan is in the chains. There are no demons, demon hordes, okay? Because they're all in chains. The heart of man is what makes things wicked during that 1,000 years. And it's all being held under because the rod of iron is keeping people in line. Okay? The rod of iron is going to cause a lot of dissension. But it's all going to be kept under. What we call it passive aggression. That's what it is. Passive aggression. Passive rebellion. So, there will be human beings with evil inclinations. There will be those from the Erev Rav who will have heard of the high places and groves and who will build them and worship at them. Israel will bring them down and burn them and teach the Erev Rav that we are not to mix our worship of Yahweh with pagan trappings. Israel will finally do what we were commanded to do when we went into the land. Kill all the pagans, destroy pagan worship, and remove all sin from our midst. Hasatan's counterfeit of this is called jihad. The righteous thing that Yahweh says to do, clean out all of that sin and get it away from you so that you're not influenced by it. Satan does the same thing, that he calls it jihad. If you don't follow the wickedness of the world, you're done. They are faithful to do it. That's exactly right. They are actually more faithful to their religion than most born-again believers are to theirs. They are more faithful to their false god than the vast majority of the church is to the real God. Hasatan's counterfeit is called jihad. Question: will we be able to remove the sin from the hearts of those who want to worship at the high places and groves? Will we be able to groves? No, not possible. We can't make people not sin. However, we are unable to police a person's thoughts. We can only police his actions. So, this sin will fester beneath the surface for a millennium, in which there will be no natural death, or next to none. The population will literally explode, and all will be born with an evil inclination. Therefore, the vast majority will comprise a seething cauldron of rebellion, awaiting the release of Hasatan from his prison. And they will accept his leadership immediately as a way to get rid of the king and his absolute control of their lives. Of course, they fail to understand, or just don't pay any attention to Revelation chapter 20 and verses 7 through 9. In verses 12 through 13 of our chapter here, chapter 27, it addresses the gathering of the saints of Yahweh from the four corners of the earth. Taken together, 12 and 13 show us that the channel of the river speaks of the Euphrates, as revealed by the reference to Asher or Assyria, to which Ephraim and Israel were carried off. And the stream of Egypt speaks of the Nile, over which a contingent of Judah passed in the days of Jeremiah, with Jeremiah, by the way, in chains accompanying them. This comprises the entire mandate of Abraham, or to Abraham, rather, in Bereshit 15 and 18. That's Genesis chapter 15 and verse 18. From the Euphrates to the Nile. The Euphrates is that which Abraham crossed over to become the first Hebrew, or crosser-overer in a Mark translation. Okay, Yahweh will regather all of his people from all over the world as an oliver gathers his olives. Did you get that, Stefan? He beats the olive tree with a stick until all the ripe olives fall to the ground, whence he picks them up. Assyria signifies the Ephraimites called out of their exile. That's mostly us, folks. Egypt signifies Judah coming out of their exile into the world and its system. What is the timing of this event? It says, in that day the great trumpet shall be blown and they shall come. Sounds like Yom Teruah to me. The day of blowing of trumpets and of shouting. Resurrection Day. What is called by our rabbinic friends, Rosh Hashanah. This will be the day when we are all put under Yahweh's protection, in Yahweh's keep. I have attempted to take a rather long passage of scripture that all goes together. It all starts in 23 and works all the way through 27. It's a one big block. And despite the somewhat arbitrary chapter divisions, and I apply it to what we see taking shape today and can foresee in our not too distant future. This is not done to frighten you or cause concern, except to let you know that if you haven't prepared for this eventuality, it's time you did. The prudent man sees the trouble coming and prepares for it in Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 3. We are in the end of days. We need to prepare our hearts and minds as well as our bodies for the time of trouble. It is coming. If, by some chance, I'm wrong, and there is a pre-tribulation rapture, doesn't matter, really doesn't, I'll just be pleasantly surprised. But if there is not a pre-tribulation rapture, and those people are not prepared for the time of Jacob's trouble, they're going to lose their faith. Lesson learned in China. Okay, that's the end of my diatribe for today. Sure, you can say something, Liz. Hang on a minute.
I just want to say, if you think that some of these things can't happen, that he told in the beginning of what's coming upon this earth, maybe it would do good to take a friend or someone and go see the movie that's out right now called Defiance. It's a true story of Jews, Russian Jews, German Jews, and whatever, at the time that they were being killed and destroyed, how three brothers took them into the wilderness of woods and how they survived in the winter without much food or whatever to be spared, and how they have many, many descendants now that are living. It's a story that you might want to see.
Yes, true story of the Holocaust. Defiance, right? Defiance. Yes, they were defiant. They defied Hitler. Okay? This is what we're going to have to do in the tribulation. We're going to have to defy the anti-Messiah that Hitler was a picture of. Okay, well, anyway, I hope that was a blessing to you all, and we'll see you next week. Shabbat Shalom in Messiah Yeshua. Eddie will be on with a rather long teaching at Midrash time today. He said at least 4 hours, so be prepared. Which means, if he said 4 hours, that means it's going to take about 4 days. Okay, like his 5-minute update takes an hour. Yeah. Oh, he did it in 5 hours, did he? Oh, he's pared it down. Yeah, this is. I got
a lot of questions and answers.
I've got a feeling that what this is kind of like the prophecy club thing that he did, where he spent 5 hours teaching Torah.
This is and
Yeshua from Genesis to Revelation.
And more.
That's pretty cool. So I'm kind of looking forward to that. So we'll see you all after Oneg. Oneg begins, oh my goodness, right now. And I didn't realize we were this late. And we're having a Thanksgiving dinner because my son is here from Germany with his wife and my grandson. My grandson came to visit me and he brought his mom and dad with him. What a nice kid. And my daughter's here from Colorado. But anyway, we'll see you guys
from Germany
in a little bit.
The highlight.
Wonderful, Mark.
Oh, good.